Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hi, my name is Danny Roth, and this is Everyday Horror. It's a podcast where we watch at least one horror movie for every day in the month of October. And then we talk about them. Today, I am joined by the host of the Maven of the Eventide YouTube series, Alisa Hansen. Hey, Lisa.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. What movie are we watching today?
Crimson Peak.
Oh, all right. So we went for it. We went right for Guillermo del Toro joint. Pre him winning lots of awards for Shape of Water. This is
back
like
before he was cool. No, he was always cool.
Yeah, this is. I don't want to make anybody feel biased, but having rewatched Crimson Peak, I found myself thinking like this is the movie that he should have won the awards for. I actually like it way more than Shape of Water.
Yeah, you know, the first time I watched Crimson Peak, I didn't, like, I thought it had a lot of things about it that I loved, 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 but something was missing, and I was like, oh, I'm disappointed in this movie. Rewatching it again for this, I'm like, what was I thinking? This is amazing. Where was I getting off? Maybe even since seeing Shape of Water. Guillermo del Toro doesn't have many duds. Like,
no, his stuff's pretty good.
He's pretty solid. You know, there's Mimic, I guess. Nobody likes Mimic. But.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, I mean, even going back, even like Blade 2, people like that Blade 2. He directed
people
that.
People love Blade 2.
So, yeah, I mean, like he's done a lot of stuff. But let's sort of like give a little bit of background. What is the story of Crimson Peak?
Crimson Peak is a gothic romance. And even though it doesn't have the word horror in it, in the Victorian times, gothic romance meant horror. Like that was horror before horror was horror. A gothic romance is a tragic romance. Sometimes it has a happy ending, but definitely not for everybody. There is dark, sinister forces. There's always a house with a personality. And this movie was Guillermo del Toro's kind of love letter to that genre.
The plot summary is young ingenue falls in love quite accidentally with sort of like what she thinks is a wealthy landowner from England.
But he's a dark, mysterious, swarthy landowner. He's not the golden boy that she should be loving. There's always someone dark and mysterious.
So yeah, so like I think conceptually, like her whole shtick is she's an author. She doesn't like this romance stuff going in. And then she ends up kind of being dragged into it. In fact, in some ways, this almost reads like, is this a meta-narrative? Is this a book she wrote? Is Crimson
Peak
like, her book?
I'm not like the other girls. I don't write love stories. I write about cool stuff like ghosts. And then she falls in love.
Yeah. And yeah, so then she goes with, so that's Edith Cushing. And so she goes with Thomas and Lucille Sharp, who are played by Tom Hiddleston and Jessica Chastain, back to their home. Even though she's gotten a bunch of ghastly premonitions from her dead mother about not going to some place called Crimson Peak, she, of course, winds up in this house, which is basically fondly referred to as Crimson Peak. And then a bunch of really messed up stuff happens, which we can sort of get to in due course. But that's sort of the setup for the film.
See, a key thing, if you're not sure if something is technically gothic, if it's named after a house, if the story is named after a house, it is gothic. Because the house is always the central figure.
That's interesting. I feel like I've been talking about, in the course of doing a podcast every day, I talk about places where a house is a central part. We actually did an episode on the Japanese classic Houssu, which is, I don't know if I'd call it gothic horror, but it's about a house specifically.
It has its roots in there. Yeah. You know, the whole haunted house sort of thing, even if there's nothing supernatural going on, like look at Jane Eyre or Wuthering Heights, like classic gothic stories that don't have real ghosts, just the feeling of it. They're all named after the house. Well, Jane Eyre isn't, but the house is important.
Do you want to sort of give a little bit of a history, as it were, of Gothic horror? Like, because this is sort of a genre that you're especially familiar with.
Yeah, it came about prior to the Victorian times, but got really big in the Victorian times. Like, technically, the Gothic era is over before Victorian times started. It was big around there. Like, you think of Dracula, Frankenstein, the picture of Dorian Gray, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, the Phantom of the Opera. Some of them are supernatural, some of them are not. There doesn't have to be real supernatural going on for something to be Gothic, but there has to be a dark, sinister atmosphere. And usually you think something supernatural is going on, and then, like Scooby-Doo, you realize it wasn't, which is the case in Crimson Peak. And Guillermo del Toro says a lot that when he writes monsters, because he's in love with monsters, he calls Frankenstein his personal religion because he hates real religion. The scary thing isn't the supernatural. It's the human side. And if you look at Crimson Peak, the ghosts are helpful. They're scary and horrible to look at, but they're trying to help Edith out. And the real horror are the very human sharps.
It's interesting. I know that for him, from a visual perspective, Del Toro was trying to do something in a Mario Bava kind of style, which is interesting because Mario Bava does do stuff like that. You know, he does like a Bay of Blood, Eric the Conqueror, but he's also like a real giallo guy. Like, one of my favorite movies, Blood and Black Lace. I mean, there's a house element. It's interesting. I didn't think about it until now, but like, there is a house that looks really crazy, and even though it's humans that are evil, it does almost have a ghastly supernatural element to it.
You know what a lot of the design, especially the lighting in this one, reminded me of was Suspiria. With all greens and, you know, the long hallways. And because you look at some of the lights in this movie and you've got this green arsenic glow, and it can't be coming from any natural source. It's clearly stylistic, but works because it's almost like a comic book palette.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to sort of call Suspiria into it, because, I mean, that's, again, that's another one of your like Italian masters. That's an Argento joint. And I think a lot of those creators from the 60s and 70s, especially prior to the Americanized version of the slasher, would make these giallo movies that had killers, but also like had a particular visual aesthetic that made things feel somewhat supernatural, although not necessarily always wind up being supernatural. So it is. It's interesting to sort of watch the evolution from Gothic romance in literature to this sort of like mid-20th century style of filmmaking in Italy, to then Guillermo trying to bring it back. And in truth, I mean, it's not as though no one was trying to do it before then, but there were a lot of duds. I always think of like the late 90s when they tried to remake The Haunting, which is
I was just thinking of that.
maybe the worst example, maybe the worst remake of all time. Probably
the house looked cool. The house was the best part of that.
It did, but it's so. But that's the trick, right? So the thing about Gothic romance / Gothic horror is that it's very easy to get caught up in the trappings and wind up with something boring. That's
or something very melodramatic and cliche. And if you look at the criticisms Crimson Peak gets, they're like, beautiful design. Actors were great. Script was terrible. It was so cliche and melodrama and cheesy. I'm like, well, was it really?
And all right, so, and I think that's a great sort of direction to go in, because I don't think it is. I think that I think it does a really wonderful job of marrying a regular narrative with a meta narrative, because it is self-aware, but mm-hmm. I don't think it's not in that 90s style where they're constantly winking at you. Like, it's not like a big old grin on your face, like, ah, do you get it? Like, it never quite felt like that to me, but it is very much a love letter to Gothic horror. And I think it really sort of begins and ends with the protagonist. Because she really is, like, the concept is she's not one of those girls. She's the cool girl, Edith Cushing. She's not. She's like, oh,
she wears glasses.
She's going to die a widow. That's her plan. She wants to be like Mary Shelley, which, by the way, I know some stuff about Mary Shelley. You don't really want to be like Mary Shelley.
Lose
Mary
your virginity Shelley on your mother's grave?
Yeah, making a lot of bad decisions, Mary Shelley. The guy she winds up with is kind of a scumbag. Didn't he like leave Mary for her younger sister?
He was awful, but
he's the worst.
He was so brooding and mysterious and hashtag aesthetic. Yeah. Didn't you like keep his calcified heart after he died? Or is that someone else's heart?
I don't know. It could be. You never know. There's like some of the stuff sort of falls into legend. You don't know what's your own, what isn't. But Mary Shelley had a messed up life. And I don't, if I was Edith Cushing, I am not sure that is how I was would have gone. That's not, but her whole concept is she is not someone that's going to be like swept off her feet. She's not going to be like a little housewife. She's not going to be making a lot of babies. Her babies are going to be her stories, her books. And her books are going to be ghost stories because she is metal, but like, you know, oldie-timey metal. And the reason we know that's true is because her dad is played by Jim Beaver from Supernatural, which is a real gas. I was like, oh, yeah, that's like really like CW metal horror.
When you have female characters that are in the I'm not like the other girls trope, it can be, you know, hashtag problematic from a feminist perspective because, well, what's wrong with the other girls? Why is femininity wrong? Why is romance wrong? Why should we shun that and take on more masculine traits like work in the Victorian era to make us better humans? Like, you know, and you don't want to fall into that trap. But I think this film avoids it because even though she does have that perspective, she is still very feminine. She doesn't think she don't need no man. She's very dependent on her father and she doesn't dismiss that kind of dependence. She works with it and she still develops a strong personality out of it. And for something that could have very easily fallen into that trap, like you look at, say, Mina in Link of Extraordinary Gentlemen, I think this one handles it very well.
Yeah, and I think something that is very interesting is the casting. So this is, again, like kind of like behind the curtain a little bit. So Mia Wasikowska was not supposed to play this role originally. Originally, the very first go around, Guillermo gave it to Jessica Chastain. He like sent the script Jessica Chastain's going to play this part. And it sort of became clear somewhere along the line that maybe they were going to cast Jessica Chastain. I guess at this point it would be considered against type. Like, I don't think this is a part
I knew her from The Help, which was such a vastly different role that I feel like she could probably play anything.
Yeah, but I don't think previous to this, people had that perception of her. So this is like classic, dark, gothic, like villainess sort of role. And you would think that would go to, there's like a woman that's like the
Ava
woman.
Green.
That's the one. Like,
it seems like, yes, you did.
Ava Green is definitely who
this
you
is Jessica
think.
Chastain as Ava Green, as Lucille Sharp.
But what's interesting about it is that I think that Mia Wasikowska is kind of doing what just like I thought it was Jessica Chastain at first. Like, I was like, Jessica Chastain looks a little different in this movie, not realizing that she looked so different that I didn't recognize her at all.
I had known Mia Wasikowska from Only Lovers Left Alive, the other movie with Tom Hiddleston, where she plays like punk rock bad girl. So yeah, again,
I mean, she's got a really interesting background too, because she plays Alice in the weird Disney Johnny Depp Alice in Wonderland movies, but she was also in Stoker as India Stoker. So she's definitely got a background in doing like weird genre stuff. I mean, she's like in like The Man with the Iron Heart. She's in like a million things. She's just friggin' Madame Bovary, you know, like she is a woman that has got a background in stuff that makes her right for this. But I had been mostly unfamiliar. I hadn't watched a lot of these other things until after the fact. So she is in it, and she is really, she's playing very feminine, playing someone who is very driven, has an identity of her own. But yeah, I don't think she's punished for being feminine. I think that she kind of embraces it in what ways that at first she had kind of eschewed it pretty early on.
She's more romantic than the other girls in her own way. So even though she says, I don't want to write romance like the other girls, when she meets the other women at the beginning who are talking about, you know, trying to bag the baronet for the society daughter Eunice, the fact that those girls are interested in money and society and social climbing is what Edith doesn't like. She would want romance for romance's sake, and she would want true feeling. So,
yeah,
what she is eschewing is not necessarily something that you shouldn't.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm down with people getting their life however they want. I think it's funny the baronet title. That's a thing you just don't hear very often.
The only other time I've heard of it is, do you know Scarlet Pimpernel?
Yes.
The Sir Percy Blakeney is a baronet. And I remember back in my fandom days of Scarlet Pimpernel, how we used to make fun of it because it was like the lowliest, weakest, loserly title of all the titles you could have.
Yeah, but Americans at the time wouldn't know that, I guess. Right. I'm assuming that they would have no idea. Like, wow, a baronet. So yeah, like this is the other, and I don't think Tom Hiddleston was not set to play this part either. It was supposed to be Benedict Cumberbatch.
Right. I read something that when he found out Jessica Chastain wasn't playing his wife, he didn't want to do it anymore. But then they were very coy about why he dropped out, and he was still supportive of it. But there seemed like there was some kind of drama there, and it has me quite intrigued. I'm so curious.
I have to tell you, I mean, I'm 100% fine with Tom Hiddleston in this role. I think he does a great job. I mean, everybody is great in this.
They said that when Guillermo del Toro cast Tom Hiddleston, he rewrote the part to make him softer and less cold. And he was going to have Benedict Cumberbatch playing a much colder character, maybe sort of like Colin Firth, Mr. Darcy style, before you find it out.
Let me ask you an honest question. Do you think that you would have preferred that?
No. I think that would have been too much in the direction of like bad boy, like, oh, she likes this dark guy who's so emotionally unavailable and that's attractive to her. And I don't think that would have made sense for her because, you know, she had a loving father. She didn't have daddy issues or anything. Like, why would she want that? He doesn't need to be Edward Cullen saying, I'm too dangerous for you. Stay away from me.
Yeah, I mean, nobody wants a Twilight romance again, except for the people that do. 50 Shades, it makes some money. Anyway, I really do think it's interesting. You're right that this baronet character, it's interesting that he is weak as far as title goes, because he is kind of a weak character in the sense that he is also, long before Emma is getting pushed around or Edith is getting pushed around, he is really the one who is just trying to make right. He's trying to keep his house alive. He's trying to keep his sister in an okay situation. He's doing the best that he can, but everybody's got expectations from him. Everybody's kind of forcing, everybody's putting baby in a corner.
And he was the baby brother too. Lucille's his older sister, so he's always been led around. He's never been a leader himself. Yeah.
So whether it's his parents or whether it's Lucille or Jim Beaver's character, Carter Cushing, who is Edith's father, like, they all kind of will force upon him an expectation. So in the immediate, the thing that we see is that that one of the core conceits is that something is not right with him. He is not, something's wrong. There's a mysterious mystery. And as a result, Carter Cushing is like, you can't be with my daughter. You got to go. You got to break her heart and then get out. And so, yeah, like, he's in a real bad spot, Thomas Sharp. He's just, he really has no control over his own destiny at this point.
The whole breaking her heart part thing really worked out for his advantage, because that is such a Victorian sort of trope where, you know, she might be a little bit into him, but not thinking of like running off and marrying him. She's known him for 2 days. But then he does this really dramatic, emotional thing to her that's negative, and then comes back the next day and says, I was forced to do that. I didn't mean it. I actually do care. And head over heels, instantly in love, she's marrying him. Like, if he had just courted her like normally, maybe she wouldn't have even gone there. But that just changed everything. And that's tropey and fabulous. And I loved it because he didn't plan to do that, but it happened anyway.
Yeah, I think what would have been kind of a trap and a mistake is when you're doing these homages slash meta narratives, sometimes there's a desire to turn a thing too far on its head. And it could have been that they were like, oh, see, like, he's bad because he's negging her. And this is something about men who neg women. And it's like, you know what? Crimson Peak doesn't need that. Not every narrative requires this. I think it's okay to have a story where, like, both of your romantic leads are in bad situations, that they are just trying to do the best that they can to work their way through. And that's sort of a nice thing, is that I think it's so easy in narratives like this and in horror movies in general to end up crafting a lot of characters that you can't like. And I like a lot of people in this movie, and I especially like Edith and Thomas. I think they're like a nice, complicated, but ultimately their hearts are in the right place kind of pairing.
And he grows up by the end. Like, he's been this sort of weak pushover all his life, and in the end he, you know, has his character arc and figures out what he needs to be a true human and then dies. But
yeah, I mean, look, a lot of that is a nice thing, is that these two characters especially take a real journey. But I mean, everybody does. Like, that's the thing, is that, you know, like, if you look at Carter Cushing, like, he's a bit of a pushover, and it's like, you know, like, likes that his daughter is strong, but then, like, kind of ends up taking a strong hand with her in a way that he doesn't expect, that shows that he's a caring father. And, you know, even in his death, like, he gets killed, and that is the other thing that sort of spurns Edith towards Thomas, is that she no longer has her father, who was like her rock. And so she goes to the person that she feels closest to in that moment, that happens to be Thomas Sharp. And but yeah, I think it's very interesting that, like, right after Carter Cushing dies, they do this whole bit where Edith has got to identify the body, and she starts talking about how he didn't want to look his age, that he was trying to not feel quite so old. And I thought, it's fascinating to me that he made a genuine decision to try to protect his daughter from something that, it turns out, kind of legit. Like, I have to say, yeah, put the shoe on the other foot.
He was entirely in the right.
Like, yeah, I mean, maybe he should have told her the truth of what was going on. But, you know, mm-hmm. I think that he was trying to sort of mitigate the circumstance as best as he could. And so I kind of understand what he's doing there, you know, especially if we take historical context into account. I'm not sure how likely it would have been for him to be like, let's sit down and have a talk, daughter of mine, about your future. And I think he does do that to an extent in the regular, like, he's very approving of her independence. And he sees this guy as a means for her to lose what independence that she has, and to a person that he thinks is kind of nefarious. So he is a different person from beginning to end. Thomas is very different from beginning to end. Edith is, I think, really almost everybody. I mean, they really, like, it's the villains that are mostly who they are at the beginning is who they are at the end. And it's more about the revelations of the truth, right, of them.
Well, though, I think Lucille has... because she's desperate. I don't think she's crazy. Maybe she is mentally ill in some ways. She did murder her mother when she was 12. But she is desperate because she is in a situation where she's in an incestuous relationship, completely dependent on a man, unable to go anywhere, do anything with any means of her own. And if she loses it, her life is over and she has to keep it. So she goes to these extremes, and you can even see at points where she's saying, like, I have no other option. You know, when she tells Thomas, like, if they knew about me, they'd hang you and they'd put me in an asylum again. And she just knows there's absolutely no other way for her. But you see that desperation go from being like a cold sort of logical thing into this flailing, screaming emotion where all this stuff she's been pending up really comes out. And I think she realizes how impossible it is. And that just kind of erupts in her. And I think that is a change too, because I don't think she was ever that hysterical before.
I think what's sort of interesting about it is that if there's sort of an evolution to it, it's that, yes, we have a sense that she for a time feels kind of trapped in the circumstance, but there is a point at the very end wherein she is presented with a solution. She is presented with a way out, but it is not the way out that she wants. So she makes a choice.
It involves Edith, and she wants him all to herself.
Yes. And, you know, basically that is what she's realized is that she likes to a degree, or she prefers the circumstance where she keeps killing wives rather than having to be in a triad. Triad's right out. She's a traditional girl, you see.
She's monogamous.
Yeah, she's very monogamous with her brother, which we'll talk about a little more in a minute. But I wanted to sort of get a vibe from you about the house, about this space, this whole area that is called Crimson Peak, because it's the title of the movie, and as a result, it's kind of important, especially visually.
Well, first of all, how cool is it when the red clay starts coming up through the snow, thereby giving its name? Like, who thought of that? Did Guillermo del Toro think of that? He's brilliant.
I mean, and what's great is that it comes out of everywhere. It just starts to seep it's more and more.
Coming down the walls in entryway. Every time they go upstairs, you see this flash of a corner where it's just this red mud coming down the walls. And it's just mud, and it's just got metal in it, which is what makes it red. But of course it looks like blood. And that's what you're going to think of.
Yeah, that again is very Dario Argento and very Mario Bava, that particular pop of color.
And the ghosts are all red because it's implied that they hid the bodies in the mud after they murdered them.
Yeah, except for the the mother figure is the only one that isn't, because she's not.
She hadn't been put into the mud.
So yeah, like that's and the ghosts are really are pretty spectacular, and the ghosts are effectively all of the previous wives, because they've been like what, three or four?
Yeah, there were three before Edith.
So you sort of see them. I don't know. Do we see all of them?
You see the one of the mother. She's the one missing the finger, the one in the bathtub.
Right.
And then you see the one with the baby. She was the last one. And then if there are others, you can't really tell them apart from each other.
Now, were you scared? Did you find that scary?
No.
Really? And you know I was kind of creeped out by that. I actually thought it was rewatching, and I was like, oh, this is creepier than I remember it being.
I liked it. I liked how creepy it was. I wasn't afraid of it. And, you know, horror movies do scare me. I'm not like, psh, I'm not scared. But I was more just like, look how cool that is with this one. I remember when this movie came out, the way they marketed it was coming out around Halloween. And it had these really grotesque ghosts and Doug Jones and all this like monster prosthetics. And the trailer and the marketing was all full of the ghosts and jump scares and stinger cords and everything. And everyone thought it was going to be a haunted house horror movie with a lot of that. And then they watched it and they thought this wasn't a horror movie. This wasn't scary. And they were like, of course it's not, because it's not a horror movie. It's a gothic movie. And those are two different things. But it was marketed like a horror movie. And I think that's a big part of why it didn't succeed. I mean, it did all right, but definitely not as well as everyone hoped.
It's marketed as a specific kind, I guess, you know, because I mean, like, by this point, I mean, it's 2015, and bless, I think that people had gotten used to these sort of jump scare style movies, you know what I mean? Like, they had started getting to like the Insidious and Sinister and all those
the found footage movies.
Sure, but yeah, like a lot of Blumhouse stuff, which is good. I mean, a lot of those movies are great, but this is nothing like that.
And I don't know that there is an audience in modern society for gothic horror outside of niche goth fans. And I think Guillermo del Toro is one of us, one of the goth fans, making movies for us. But as far as teenagers going out to the theater to see a scary movie around Halloween, he's going to disappoint a lot of people. And even if the studios had been very honest about what this movie was in the trailers, it probably would have gotten fewer butts in the seats in the first place, because people have been like, oh, that looks like some old-fashioned costume romance thing. I'm not interested.
Yeah, it's sort of tricky, right? It's like, how much do you trust an audience to just know that a thing is going to be good? Because that's the thing. I mean, like, the movie is good. Rewatching it, it was the same thing. When I watched it when it first came out, I guess I had an expectation, and I thought, well, it's fine. And then rewatching it, I thought, this is like one of the best things Guillermo del Toro has ever done. And that's saying something, at least to me, you know. I mean, he's done a lot of things. But in the context of him having won so many awards for Shape of Water, I was like, man, I mean, Shape of Water is fine, but This is way better.
It makes Shape of Water look like a children's fairy tale, kind of. Because the messages in Shape of Water were, you know, who is the monster, who is the man. Similar to Crimson Peak, the real evil isn't the ghosts, it's the humans. But it was in such a more overt way in Shape of Water, whereas I feel like Crimson Peak was a lot more subtle about it.
Well, yeah, and I think it's more mature. I think that Crimson Peak, it kind of has this benefit that, you know, our protagonist can speak. So that's kind of an, I mean, like, not that that there's not an interest to having a protagonist that does not speak and you have to understand through action, but I think that we get a whole lot from being able to really know what Edith is thinking because she says it out loud, you know. It makes a pretty stark change, and it's one of the things that, like, I don't know, I just think Edith Cushing is a really great protagonist, and I think that our, again, the villains, especially, I mean, Lucille Sharp is, like, such, what a cool villain. I think that's, to me, like, looking back on it and realizing that somewhere along the line, Guillermo was, like, not going to have Jessica Chastain be the ingenue, going to have her be this sort
of... She wanted it. She read the script and she said, let me play the villain, please. This is such an awesome part. I want it.
Yeah, I feel like very, very rare is the occasion where a woman gets to play a role quite like this. Because she's great and I really like her. Like, the thing is, I don't hate Lucille Sharp. I have a great swelling of sympathy for her. And yet also I understand that she is monstrous. But the way that it's performed is so charismatic. My favorite moment in the whole film is... So we're in the house and actually, you know, let me just say one thing about the house very quickly, not to skip too many grooves. But I love the metaphor that the house is falling apart just in the same mm-hmm. way as this scheme, this way that that Thomas and Lucille have been trying to live is also falling apart.
Also, like, the aristocracy is falling apart, like the world is changing. You know, Lucille is the villain, but really society is the villain. Because yeah. Society has put her as a woman in this era, in this position, that brought her to this.
Yeah, which is, again, a part of the meta-narrative, because the book that Edith is writing is partially about that, too, if memory serves.
Yeah.
Is the breakdown of society, and yeah, like, in the real villain, or the real monsters, you know, I don't know. But is the
ghost
fact
is
that,
just
like,
the metaphor for the past.
Yeah. So, like, it's literally, you know, it's so interesting to watch that, like, the book that she was writing in the beginning kind of ends up being Crimson Peak, the movie that we watched, sort of by accident, quote. But, yeah, I think what's great about Lucille Sharp is that she is, I get her. I really get her. And Jessica Chastain's performance is, like, I don't know, where's her Oscar? Where's her Oscar for this?
She's the only one that won any awards. Like, of the awards the film won, which weren't many, she won two of them. And it won, like, five total, so.
Yeah, but I mean, like, if anyone's going to get an award, it's got to be her. I think she's really the most... standout. Was she my favorite? All right, so my favorite moment in the whole movie is Edith has discovered Lucille and Thomas in bed together. She is angry. She is freaking out. She runs back into the main sort of area, but she's all the way up a couple layers with the steps or elevator or whatever. And Lucille comes around and Edith very defiantly is like, "See, I knew that you weren't really a sister." Oh, I love how naive she is in that moment, and I love that Lucille Sharp is like, "Nah, bitch, I am," and then, like, just shoves her. It's so good. It's the best. Like, the movie is so great. But
and then
I
she
was
lands
howling.
On Chekhov's pile of snow.
Yeah, but I love that bit. Is so melodramatic, so over the top, so almost like that's as campy as the movie gets. But it's so earned. It's so satisfying that I love it. It is genuinely, like, there's a lot to love. There's a lot of nuance, but man, that big moment that sort of transitions us to, like, the real meat of the third act is so good.
It's set up as if to imply that incest is the greatest horror of all. Like, she already knew murder was happening. She already knew all this other stuff was happening. And then, like, the crowning cherry on top is incest.
Which is not uncommon. I mean, that's the thing in the aristocracy of the time. Like, there was plenty of it. I'm sort of surprised that she's surprised. I guess this is like naive Americanism once
again. Right, exactly. It's also a very gothic trope, too. Like, you look at Edgar Allan Poe, House of Usher, stuff like that. It's like, oh, Edith, I thought you knew ghost stories. Come on.
Yeah, like, you're surprised that they're brother and sister? I mean,
sweetie. Sweet summer child.
Yeah, get it together. This is Crimson Peak.
She needs to read more fanfic or something.
I guess so. I guess there. I mean, like, I don't know the history of fanfiction. Where does it really begin? I'm trying to think what else we can sort of cover for sure. But we're like, what was the stuff that you really loved? Like, what are your sort of favorite elements of it?
I like the butterfly moth metaphor thing, because when you put in something symbolic like that, it's hard to do with it without being cheesy. And I think this movie managed it. You know, the butterfly symbolizing Edith and the moth symbolizing Lucille. And, you know, transformation, the fact that Edith transforms by the end and the way the colors are connected. The butterflies are gold, like all of Edith's dresses. And we start seeing it off with all butterflies dying and moths surviving. And in the end, it's the opposite.
Yeah, that's a really cool visual. I had completely skipped over that, but it's a pretty neat way of sort of visually explaining the story in case you missed it.
And when she says, oh, what do the moths eat? And Lucille says, butterflies.
Yeah, it's good. Hey, I mean, like, all their stuff is great. You. Yeah, I love that. The sort of conflict between the two of them is, again, like, really juicy, a little bit melodramatic, but super, super entertaining. I like the do you like the fact that she's getting poisoned by the tea? That also is. Yeah,
and then when she figures it out and she's like, no, I put the poison in the porridge this time.
Yeah, I was like, that line. A smart villain.
Yeah, because I wasn't expecting that. That one surprised me. And, you know, I thought I knew all the cliches.
Yeah, it was pretty slick where, it's literally just we had been using this one means to poison her, but she figured it out. So now she won't drink the tea. So that's all right. Put it in the other thing that she somehow insanely, because she hasn't thought for more than 2 seconds that maybe we would poison everything, that she thinks the porridge will be okay. But I believe that. I absolutely believe that someone who writes stories would become convinced that life is like a story, and that would again not have that kind of nuance, and that villains wouldn't have that kind of intelligence.
If you're familiar with Jane Austen, she wrote Northanger Abbey, which is about a girl who's super into gothic literature, and she goes to this spooky house and she sort of imagines that she's in a gothic story, and then, you know, kind of grows up and figures life out. And it really reminded me a lot of that whole naivete of someone who thinks they're so genre savvy, really doesn't know anything about what real darkness is.
Yeah. But I think the ending is, it's sort of still, what's interesting about it is that it does kind of marry reality with what a book would be like. Because, I mean, there is a ghost. There are multiple ghosts. And then in the end, Thomas becomes one of those ghosts, and that's really the...
And it seems like he passes on, doesn't it? Like,
yeah, I guess after he does it, trapped. He's done. He moves on.
Like, I don't know if he just disappeared or if he's supposed to be implied that he went on to the afterlife, whatever it is. And then Lucille is trapped in the house, but she never wanted to leave the house, and Thomas wanted to get away from the house, so they both got what they wanted.
Yeah. Here's one good thing about the movie not being successful. They never made a sequel, right?
Yeah.
No sequel, no straight to video I don't know about that somebody tried to pull out of their hat. That would have been terrible.
I guess he did Pacific Rim 2.
Yeah, but that's not, I mean, like, that's, I don't know. Pacific Rim by its very nature is built and, again, is paying an ode towards things that are designed to have sequels, to create more. You know, I mean, like, Gojira, you know, begets like Rodan and Mothra and, you know, and a million other things.
Well, the thing about gothic stuff is that sequels don't work because they end tragically and beautifully with some sense of resolution. And if you try to do a sequel, you're going to have to undo something you resolved at the end. Because, like, look at Phantom of the Opera in the sequel, Love Never Dies. Like, Phantom of the Opera ends when the monster learns to love and lets her go and sets her free. And he loves her enough to let her go. And then the sequel comes along and it's like, never mind, I want you back now. And yeah. The whole gothic resolution is gone.
So rather than that, let's do this. Let's say someone watched Crimson Peak and thought, wow, that movie's great. Like us, let's say. Now they want to, but they don't really have a huge familiarity with gothic romance and gothic horror. Like, what's another
fanfickers, and they want to do it anyway.
There you go. What other movie? Like, what would your recommendation be? Like, here's the next thing to watch.
If it's aesthetic you like, monsters with feelings, I would say Interview with the Vampire. It's set in a similar era. It's got the costumes, the drama, the blood, the monsters that aren't more human than the humans are. I'm trying to think of any other ghost stories, but they're like, so many ghost stories are a modern person discovering something from the past, not that good, juicy Victorian ghost.
I have two that I would say. One that I think is a lot of people are not in love with, but I think, again, maybe like Crimson Peak, if you gave it another shot, you might discover that you like it. And that is Daniel Radcliffe and The Woman in Black.
I haven't seen that. I've been curious. Now I'll watch it because you said that.
It's pretty, I would say it adheres a lot more towards the James Wanification of modern horror that has like the jump scares and stuff. Like, it is not as sort of rich and slow moving as a Crimson Peak, but it does still have elements of that. And I enjoyed it. And I thought that Daniel Radcliffe does a really solid job. And then I think probably the most obvious one for me, I would say it's got to be The Others. That's what I would say, like, man, watch 2001's The Others with Nicole Kidman. Like, I mean, it's kind of a different side of the die, but slow moving. It's got a cool twist to it. It's definitely got a lot about a house. It's definitely got a real gothic element to it, I think.
If you ask me to recommend books, there are so many books that have that Crimson Peak aesthetic. But even when I didn't love Crimson Peak before I rewatched it, when I was just like, oh, I'm disappointed, it's not what I wanted it to be, I would still have to cite it as the representative of my aesthetic or what I look for in a movie, because it's one of the only ones out there that really goes there with the visual sense.
I want to know the books then. Like, give people some book recommendations. We don't usually get those, but yeah, I mean, why not?
These are all classics. So like Rebecca by Daphne Du Maurier, Wuthering Heights, of course.
You think those are like the two big ones? Like, you'll get the vibe, like, that's kind of got like a similar feeling to it that Crimson Peak does?
Yeah. There's a big house, mysterious stuff going on. You've got a crazy lady with a ring of keys who's coming after you. That whole feminine struggle.
And
Jane Eyre, of course.
And Rebecca, didn't someone try to make like Rebecca on Broadway for like many years and then it just never happened? Am I imagining that?
Oh, man.
I think so. That's like one of those things where it's like, we're going to do it. It was someone's passion project. And like, there was like a sign up for like 2 or 3 years and it just never came into existence.
I know they did The Woman in White on Broadway and that was kind of a disaster.
Oh yeah. Jeez, gosh. Well, that's kind of another beast. Anyway, that's Crimson Peak. Lisa, you want to tell people where folks can find you on the internet?
Well, if you like hearing me talk about gothic things, I have a show for you. I talk about vampires, usually movies, but also books sometimes, other media. Vampire Reviews on YouTube. Maven of the Eventide is my channel name. And I will tell you all the subtle layers, metaphors, allegories, societal issues in vampire fiction from a feminist perspective. So if you want to hear what all these things mean on a deeper level, whether you like it or not, I will tell you.
Oh, all right. Where can people find you on social media?
On Twitter, I am Elisa in Time, like Elisa in Space, but in time. And on Facebook, I am at Maven of the Eventide as well.
Cool. My name is Danny Roth, and you can find all the things that I write and the videos that I'm in and the Lord 20 billion podcasts I do at sci-fi.com. And on Twitter and Instagram, I am at Danny Ordinary. That is Danny with one N. Ordinary, also with one N. Thank you for listening.
Oh, wait. And go ahead. I should plug my book.
Go ahead and plug your book.
I have a book coming out very soon. Perhaps it will be out even by the time this airs, depending on timing. But it's called The Company of Death, and it is a zombie apocalypse book where the Grim Reaper goes on an adventure. So look for that under my name, Alisa Hansen.
Nice. Yes, thank you for listening. And remember, sometimes the best cure for the horrors of every day is little everyday horror. We'll see you next time.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.